We have to organize the humanitarian relief in a way that Hamas cannot take control of it and criminal groups cannot take control of it. Now, there will have to be at the beginning Israeli security control, but you need at the very beginning some kind of structure that we have not discussed yet and we don't know yet fully.
Du hører på Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra Tankesmien Civitan.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Mathilde Fasting and today I'm joined by my colleague Professor Torkel Brekke and by Professor Yair Hirschfeld online from Tel Aviv. Professor Hirschfeld has a unique experience from peace negotiations between Israel and Palestine, as well as the Oslo peace process, and will soon publish a book about the peace process. The topic for today's conversation will be the ongoing war in Gaza and the possible future for Israelis and Palestinians. And the aim will be to get a better understanding on the conflict. It's also 30 years since the Oslo peace accord was signed, almost at the same time as Hamas attacked Israeli civilians on October 7th. Welcome, both of you.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We'll start with you, Professor Hirschfeld. Most Norwegians think of the Oslo peace process as something that started in September 1993. But you have been engaged in the dialogue between Israel and the PLO many years prior to this, and this formed the background of the Oslo process. When and how did the peace process really start, and what was your role?
No, you know, it starts in September 1978, Prime Minister Begin, President Sadat, and Jimmy Carter signing the Camp David Accords. And there is, it says how to promote peace also between Israelis and Palestinians. And it is a blueprint how to work on it. At the time, was a PhD student. I finished my PhD on Iranian studies. And I understood from the beginning that it is not easy to negotiate on the basis of the agreement. An Israeli-Palestinian understanding. The Palestinians opposed it, the Jordanians opposed it. There was strong Iraqi opposition. And in my field was Iran, and in 1979, you may remember that Mr. Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, took power in Iran. And then I was asked to participate in a TV session in Austria, because I grew up in Vienna. And the Austrian Prime Minister, Dr. Kreisky, saw me and asked to see me. And the reason was that I explained in 1979 that the takeover of an Islamic militant regime in Iran made an agreement between Israel and the Palestinians totally impossible. Because the entire balance, the regional balance for reaching an agreement was heavily disturbed. So the discussions with Kreisky were how, instead of this, to move ahead. And I suggested to him to meet King Hussein, King of Jordan, and maybe speak also to Chairman Arafat, and suggest to build up what they call the self-government agreement for the Palestinians bottom-up by offering economic aid. If they get economic aid and economic development plan, the logic would be that they would like want to defend the Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza. They would want to defend their economic privileges and rights and the economic development concept by legal measures. And this would actually be a building up self-government from below. And Kreisky took this to King Hussein. He got a paper from King Hussein. I brought this paper to Shimon Peres and to his deputy Yossi Beilin. And from that moment on, which is the September 1980 onwards, I organized for Shimon Peres and for Yossi Beilin and other members of the Labour Party meetings in the West Bank and Gaza with PLO supporters, with Jordan supporters, with business people, with journalists, and many more. That's how I went into it. So I went from 1979 or 1980 until I started the Oslo negotiations. I went through a 13-year process of trial and error, of learning, of building trust, of creating networks, not only with the Palestinians, but also with Egyptians, Jordanians, getting confidence from the Israeli leadership, and also, quite importantly, with the Americans.
So then you entered into the processes itself, the Oslo peace process. So how what was your role then, and what happened?
Now, yeah, you know, we went through different stages. So you have in October, October, the end of October, beginning of November 1991, you've got the Madrid conference. I was sent by Shimon Peres to be with the Palestinian delegation, the Europeans and the Americans at the Madrid conference, and to report to him what happened. At the end, in the 3rd of November, official Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, Israeli-Jordanian-Palestinian negotiations started in Madrid. And I had enough good relations with the Palestinian delegation that they gave me their negotiation papers. And the negotiation papers then that came out, so I got a clear picture of what is the Israeli position, what are the Palestinian positions. And this allowed me to write for the European Union a study, Israel, the Palestinians, and the Middle East from dependency to interdependence. It's a 160-page study which prepared the Oslo negotiations. I developed three different models for negotiations. The one the Israelis didn't like, the other ones the Palestinians didn't like, but the third one, both sides, I got the agreement from both sides. And I had quite, by that time, quite a lot of experience. And then Rabin got elected. I finished the study before Rabin got elected in June 1992. Then Rabin got elected in June 1992. And there was a division between bilateral negotiations, Israeli-Palestinians, the Jordanians were already out, and multilateral negotiations. In Madrid, five multilateral negotiations groups were formed on arms control, on environment, on water, on economic development, and on refugees. And Peres was in charge of dealing with the multilateral negotiations. And I was sent to the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank, to Faisal Husseini, who was a wonderful man, and to Hanan Ashrawi, to work with them on a negotiation concept, how to allow Palestinians from from outside, from the Palestinian diaspora, to participate in these negotiations. I got a paper from Hanan Ashrawi, a yellow little paper, where she wrote the formula. I brought it to Peres. Peres looked at the formula and said, go back to Hanan and say, it's okay. I'm fine with it. I go to Hanan and I don't get an answer. She says, wait. And I have a lot of, I've got a lot of tendencies, but I'm not patient. So I phone her five times a day, six times a day. Then afterwards, you know, I stop. After a week or something like this, the Middle East advisor of President Mubarak comes into Jerusalem, goes into the office of Shimon Peres, and gives him a formula from Arafat, which is less good for the Palestinians than what Peres agreed to Hanan Ashrawi. There was a clear measure, it was a clear sign from Arafat that said, whatever the local leadership says and whatever the delegation says that goes to Washington doesn't count. What I will block them, and if you speak to me, we can go ahead. So I was told again and again and again, go and speak to the PLO people.
So you're describing a lack of coordination on the Palestinian side in this early phase, or is Arafat personally who wants to be in the center of it?
No, it is Arafat is a very dominant position, and he decides what happened, and everybody else asks him and doesn't do anything which doesn't have his okay. He's the very dominant leader, not an easy leader, but he is controlling everything. You know, I'll give you this more. In the Gulf War of nine, if you remember, there was the Gulf War of 1991. Arafat supported Saddam Hussein, and the Saudis went wild. The Saudis went to see Faisal Husseini and offered him a check and said, this is a check. Put in whatever sum you want, $10 billion, $40 billion, $80 billion, whatever you want. Create an organization to put those PLO people out of the game and you lead the Palestinians. And Faisal said no. Faisal told me, I had hundreds and hundreds of hours with him. Faisal told me, this reminded me of 36, 39. There one Palestinian organization was fighting the others. I didn't want a civil war, so I wouldn't do that. And I accept the leadership of Arafat, even if it's difficult, and even if he's very, very, very aggressive against, but it was not easy to fight Saddam Hussein. And so he didn't take this check. He was a very decent man. He probably was also afraid of being killed. Arafat had complete control. You know, in Madrid, you need to understand how this worked in Madrid. In Madrid, you had all the PLO people in Hotel Victoria, and they were all there, and they were there was the official delegation, but they were the minority. But in spite of the end that all the PLO people were there to control them, they were flown out of Madrid to Tunis during the negotiations to get orders from Arafat. And at this situation, Arafat took Kate also to put Faisal into a very defensive position. But it was Arafat who totally controlled the negotiations. And then the Argentine said, it doesn't work on us. My own decision was to go and with the help of Hanan Ashrawi, we arranged a meeting with Abu Ala in London. I happened to see Tari Larson on the same day and had the guts to tell Tari that I'm going to see Abu Ala. And Tari offered all support, and he stood up to what he promised. He afterwards committed. He afterwards really did give all the support. But this was the beginning, and from then on, we moved already rather quickly to negotiations in Norway. Not in Oslo, by the way, but in Salzburg.
In Salzburg, yes. And the person you talked about there was Terje Lørød Larsen, for the Norwegian listeners, so who was central in the Oslo Peace Accord. And as you correctly say,
he wasn't a negotiator, but he helped to facilitate it.
Facilitate, yes. And that's why it also happened in Salzburg, as you correctly said. It's a neighboring town of Oslo. But then again, it was signed, and in November 1995, Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, and in May 1996, Benjamin Netanyahu won the elections in Israel by a slim margin. And I'd like to have your comments on this. How did this change this change in political leadership? What did this mean to the peace process that was signed just a few years before, was 2 years before?
You know, Rabin's way of leading the negotiation was to build a partnership with Arafat. And Netanyahu was far more confrontational. But it didn't change the Oslo process. We signed, there were still, Netanyahu signed the Hebron Agreement, and there was the note for the record, and he signed the Wye River Agreement. So the negotiations went on. The Oslo process went on. The Oslo process was not killed by Netanyahu. It became more difficult, maybe more complex. But in a way, you know, the Palestinians, I'll give you the very leading Palestinians, I can tell you the name, Sari Nusseibeh, who's a wonderful man. Saren Nusseibeh in 95, when Rabin still was living, told me, Yair, the Labour Party should not lead the peace negotiations. The Labour Party should not lead the peace negotiations. The Labour Party wants to go too fast. This will create too much pressure on the Palestinian political system. He didn't say it will explode, but it actually did then. And it is important that the Likud will lead and that the peace camp will offer safeguard to the Palestinian leadership. It's exactly what happened between 96 and 99. Between 96 and 99, Beilin and Chaim Ramon and Nimrod had once a month, sometimes twice a month, sometimes once in 2 months, meetings with Abu Mazen and with Saeb Arafat, sometimes also with other people, to help to see how to manage the negotiations. And I established the organization called ECF, Economic Cooperation Foundation. We did a lot of work behind this, not even behind the scenes, in cooperation with the Palestinians. We had many, many working groups on Jerusalem, on refugees, on everything you want. We were working on a model for permanent status, which we concluded on the 31st of October, 1995. The so-called Beilin Abu Mazen understanding, or so I don't want to hurt Norwegian feelings. We called it the Stockholm Agreement because we negotiated it with Swedish support. And it's the biggest mistake I made. Before we concluded the Beilin Abu Mazen understanding, Arafat called me and Arafat asked me, Arafat said, Yair, I understand that you're negotiating this thing with Abu Mazen. My advice is don't conclude it. We're not ready for it. The gap is too big. We have to go gradually, step by step. And I beg you, don't sign it. And we didn't listen to him. And I regret. I told before, it's the biggest mistake I think I ever made. We should have listened to Arafat. We shouldn't have signed the Beilin Abu Mazen understanding creates the imaginary Fata Morgana that you can reach an agreement on everything, end of conflict and finality of claims without taking care of many religious and other issues. And it's been a major cause for failure.
Okay, Torkel, would you like to ask a question?
Yes, I mean, we're talking about the Oslo peace process, and Yair was in the middle of that through the process and before, you mentioned, you started talking, Yair, a little bit about what did or did not derail or stop the process or what made it harder or not. I just want to ask you about the role of violence and terrorism, because we know that Hamas worked hard from the late 80s and through the 90s to spoil the peace process by the use of violence. And I wonder how significant this was in your eyes. I mean, what did terrorism achieve in derailing or spoiling the peace, do you think?
You know, they did in the end, but I want to give you the context. In the 1990s, there was a unipolar system. You had the Soviet Union had broken down. There was the wall, the Berlin Wall had fallen down. The United States was the overriding power in the world. There had been a war in the Middle East where Saddam Hussein was defeated. The regional powers, Saudi Arabia, said that in the war, Saddam rockets fell at the same time at Riyadh and in Tel Aviv, and we can make peace with Israel. And on the local Israeli-Palestinian level, there was the Intifada, And both sides understood we have to negotiate with one another. So there was very serious Hamas disturbance in the 1990s. And I had a meeting with Arafat where I told him, for heaven's sake, put an end to it. And he shouted at me, you take care of your problems, I take care of my problems. So there was the Hamas problem. But the system was strong enough to sustain the process. The process continued. The process continued on. This changed with 9/11. This changed with 9/11. 9/11 was the, you know, the ISIS attack on the United States, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, and all the, suddenly the Hamas was not there alone. This was Hamas and this was Iran and this was Hezbollah. This was the entire, what we call the axis of evil today, which then was also the axis of evil. And it made it impossible for the Palestinians to reach an understanding. I want you to understand, in October, on the 31st of October 1995, Abu Mazen was in our office, in the office of ECF in Daphne Street 22B in Tel Aviv, and we concluded the Berlin-Abu Mazen agreement. And then I took Abu Mazen home in his car, in my car, to Herzliya to see the Egyptian ambassador. And on the way, and I'll show you by hands, on the way, Abu Mazen tells me, Yair, we will get to this building, Abu Mazen, this way or that way. It will be ups and there will be downs, but I'm going for it and I'm standing for it. And after 9/11, he retracted. He didn't. In 2008, Olmert offers Abu Mazen a deal, which is a little bit better than what we did Berlin Abu Mazen in 1995. It's the same exchange of territory, and on Jerusalem it's better, and on refugees it's a little bit different, but it's better than what we offered in 1995. And I'm sure that in 1995 he wanted to do it, because the position he could get enough support from the Americans, from the Saudis, from the others. In 2008, he could not, because there was Hamas in Gaza, there was Iran, there were too much spoilers there he couldn't live up to. And he, to tell you the truth, he had some certainty to know that if he signs, he will be killed.
I think we'll have to return to Iran and the role of that country as you started talking about, Yair. But I just want to connect this a little bit to the Norwegian discourse, as this is, after all, a Norwegian podcast. I mean, there has emerged a narrative in Norwegian media, and I think it's a very dominant narrative now, saying that the peace process was never really a genuine effort from the Israeli side, and that the Palestinians were, in a sense, framed or tricked from the start. What do you think about this narrative?
You know, from my point of view, it's outrageous. For me, this is an insult. It's very clear. But also Rabin and Olmert and all of us. But let me try to be as fair as possible as I can, which an insult. We have two narratives, and both have some little bit of legitimacy. The Israeli narrative is that we went out of our way to go for a two-state solution. We offered all the time, we want a strong Palestinian people. We offered everything we could, and every proposal for us was rejected. And I can go through 15 examples. But the Berlin Abu Mazen was rejected. Ehud Barak's proposals was rejected. The Clinton parameters were rejected. On the Sharon things, important things were rejected. On the Olmert, the roadmap was in reality rejected. On the second phase was rejected. The Olmert proposal was rejected all along. So we have been cheated by the Palestinians by rejectionism, which has got us more and more in, and then always taking us responsible for the disaster. The Palestinians have a different narrative. The Palestinians have a narrative that when we went along, we didn't accept all their demands, which is true, which you don't do in negotiations, and there were settlements going on. And the settlements were to undermine it. But to say that we were not serious is simply an untruth and based on lack of information.
Hmm. Torkel, do you have any comments on this, as you also know, about something about the Norwegian?
Yeah, I'm just so curious about how this particular narrative has emerged in Norway, because I do really think it is very strong here. And it puzzles me because I'm not an expert like Yair, but I've read at least some of the important literature about the peace process. And it doesn't seem, I mean, so I wonder why this kind of narrative has come to dominate Norwegian discourse. And I just wonder sometimes whether it's a way to deal with some kind of disappointment or some feeling that one is no longer relevant for the peace process, perhaps. I don't know. It's just an interesting development that...
Three or four explanations. I think the first explanation is that people don't understand the situation of others. And I'll give you, if I've written in the paper... I'll tell you seemingly a joke, which not really is a joke. You know, the story of Holocaust survivors are sitting together and telling each other jokes about the Holocaust. And God is coming, and God says, "It's interesting, I want to join you and to listen." And they look at God and says, "You know, we suggest don't come here. You won't understand, you were not there." And if God doesn't understand, for heaven's sakes, why should the Norwegians understand? You don't understand the situation of other people. Now, one reason is lack of information, total lack of information, and being told all kinds of stories. Another reason is more serious and very worrisome. And another reason is that in the world, there is a sense of... particularly among the left, I come from the left, by the way, and like a sense of anti-colonialism. And we are wrongly and unfairly seen as an outcome of imperialist activity. There were never Jews in Palestine. There's no Jewish history. There's no Jewish homeland. And if all the times throughout the last 2,000 years, there were always Jews in here, it doesn't really matter. It's all an imperialist thing. Now, if we an colonialist outcome, our very existence is a threat to our very existence is a war crime. You know, my house is a war crime. My garden is a war crime. But people fall into that and said, okay, they shouldn't be there. Should only the Palestinians be there? And that gets to this terrible, terrible slogan of "from the river to the sea," which is a genocidal slogan. And I don't think Norwegians would say that they're aware of what they're saying.
So we can move on a bit, Torkel, and also stick to the Norwegian reality. And that, of course, brings us up to October 7th. And, of course, we can also mention things happening before October 7th, because we are not making this huge leap from the Oslo peace process 30 years ago and up to the 7th of October. So if you have anything interesting and worthwhile talking about in between, and also, of course, the process or the things happening just before October 7th. Please feel free to comment. But you first, Torkel.
No, I think what Yair was saying is very, very important. I think this whole idea of Israel being a colonial construct and that the use of the term settler colonialism has become extremely popular. Forgetting, of course, that there were always Jews in Palestine, and of course, forgetting that that a very big chunk of Israeli Jews hail from Africa and the Middle East and not from Europe and so on and so on and so on. We can go on talking about those terms and that worldview that informs sort of the global left and of course has an impact also in Norway. But yeah, so moving on from the Oslo process to the 7th October massacres and the aftermath, it's very tempting to ask you, Yair, having seen all these large demonstrations in Western capitals and having seen, I would say in this country, having seen the reluctance to reach out and show sympathy with Israeli victims. I mean, there's a lot of detail that could be filled in here, and I won't go into that. But I think I want to ask you, Yair, if you feel that Hamas, in a way, has won the propaganda war after 7th October.
We are not in a propaganda war. We're in a fight for existence and for life. I have 10 grandchildren. I have my 4 children and their spouses. We want to live decently and morally in this country. And we are fighting for it. And in the end, it may be wrong, but the substance is more important. Now the outrageous lack of willingness to condemn murder, throwing babies into an oven firing, torturing children in front of their parents, raping women and then killing them, taking hostages and torturing them during the hostage side, invading a country that doesn't belong to you without any doing, and killing, destroying the homes of causing over 130,000, 140,000 people, destroying their homes, sending rockets at civilian purposes. These are all war crimes. Now, the truth is that I would tell your Norwegian friends who do not to demonstrate and say, no, you know, who cares about these babies being burned, who cares about these things? I would tell them that the Islamic persecutor of the ICC, the International Court, Criminal Court in Den Haag, has been here and he's gone here. And I would show them his statement. He has said, for heaven's sake, these are outrageous crimes. And these are not only crimes against Israeli people, they're crimes against the world. And if the world doesn't stand up against it, this will hit them everywhere. And I will persecute those crimes and go on to persecute these crimes. Now, he's Muslim. He's a Muslim. His name is Karim Khan. Karim Khan, KC, whatever the KC stands for. And you know, maybe some of the Judeans, if the Judeans know better than the Muslim judge of the Islam, if the International Court of Criminal Court will let them live and take care of their own homes, they should. But I'm upset about it. I'm irritated about it. But we will fight our fight for decency independent of those idiots. They're more than idiots. This is more than, it's worse than idiots.
Would you like to add something, Torkel? Because what you were thinking about, for instance, as we see in the Norwegian media and also in Western capitals when they want to support Palestinians, the story that they are being presented is more the story about what's happening in Gaza right now. And then pictures and interviews and everything, films, they go viral all the time about the destructions in Gaza. So you are kind of also fighting this fight of opinion from people who are not there and people who cannot understand what you just said and they don't know about the things that you just said. So that is probably something that both you, Torkel, and you, Yair, can comment on.
Well, yeah.
Would you like to?
What is disturbing is that you see all this. I mean, it slips so easily into deeply disturbing ideas and narratives. I mean, one thing is to criticize the concrete sort of operations, what's going on the ground, etc. But another, I mean, it's become so common now to say that, you know, the problem is you know, the whole, as Yair said, the whole existence of Israel. You know, you see all the slogans about 75 years of occupation. You know, it's going back to 48, and it's from the river to the sea. And you can say, as you said, Yair, maybe people don't understand, but still, I mean, these are in a way tropes, ideas, narratives that come out of well, at least you can connect them to classical sort of Soviet anti-Zionist propaganda arising in the 60s, being developed in the 70s, being taken over by the global left, and now it's sort of reached much of global political culture, and we see that in the streets now, and it's amazing and very disturbing to me, at least. And it's strange that we don't. I mean, in many European countries do have politicians who speak up against this, but not everywhere. It's a mixed picture.
Yair?
I think you have got two or three difficulties with it, but I obviously agree with what you're saying. There is a humanitarian disaster happening in Gaza now. From my point of view, and this is the unbelievable, the criminals are Hamas, who, you had, Marzouk, bin Marzouk, Hamas leader in speaking on the Russian TV, some time ago, and saying, we built the tunnels in order to defend our fighters, and we don't care what is happening above the ground. It is the UN and the Israeli people have to take care of it. And it's not easy to take care of people when you're in a war against people, criminals like this. And part of the crimes of Hamas are the crimes against their own people. And I hope that after the war, this becomes more and more clear, and there are already starting signs of going in this direction, that the Palestinian people will put those criminals on the court, and they will judge them for crimes against the Palestinian people. We are trying to decrease suffering as much as possible. Doing it in war is a difficult thing. Part of it, you have the Israeli public fighting for, let us make human pauses for get the hostages out. This would give way to organize humanitarian relief. Now the Americans are pressing us. The Hamas has rejected to relieve the women and girls, afraid of, I am an American diplomat told me they're afraid that they will come out and tell what crimes they've done to them. Now the Americans are pressing us, I think rightfully, to support humanitarian relief, also if the hostages are not freed. Now, we have opened 2 days ago, humanitarian relief is not only coming in from Egypt, but also from Israel, also from that. So this is strong American pressure on the Israeli government to do that. And the Israeli government is going along with it, probably not enough. But the situation, the human suffering is tremendous, no question.
We are just for the listeners, we are recording this on December 11th. So we are still in a situation where the war is going on. And as you said, referring to 2 days ago, will that be the 9th of December? So, but then I've read very interestingly the first chapter of your book To Come. We can talk about that later, but it's lots of interesting things in the first chapter already. So how important is the wider regional context to what is happening in Gaza as we're bringing this into to a wider picture? And then I'm thinking about the role of Hamas and their so-called, as you called it axis of evil, axis of resistance in particular. And you can explain a bit about those things going on there, as you also try to do in your chapter.
What I'm saying all along is this is not a bilateral struggle. This is a global and regional struggle. The threat against Israel, with all due respect, is not merely from the Hamas. It's from Hamas, Hezbollah. Hezbollah have over 170,000 rockets and missiles that they can go every time against us and cause tremendous destruction. It is the support of Iran. Now the Iranians are encouraging the Houthis. They're delivering the Houthis with arms in order to attack us from the south. It is the Iranian call for genocide. You had Iranians rockets going all along in streets for years and years, for the last 20 years, on the rockets and missiles who can hit us. It says, death to Israel, morge Israel, death to Israel. And they're calling for the destruction of the state of Israel. This is a genocidal regime. They're torturing their own people. They're hanging their own people. Now they are supported by Russia. They are sending drones to Russia to fight in Ukraine. China is half in, half out, but happy to weaken the West. The cause of the war, the major cause of the war, was the fact that President Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince and Netanyahu were negotiating a Israeli-Palestinian-Saudi peace agreement, which was supported also by the Europeans who are working with the Saudis, United Arab Emirates, Jordan, and Egypt. And we were working on track two with the Palestinians, how to fit this all together and get this, prepare this for a Palestinian, Israeli-Palestinian move towards a two-state solution. And the idea was so powerful that the idea was to create an entire alliance from the United States, Europe, Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, the Gulf Cooperation Council states, go to India, Malaysia, Indonesia, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand. We had in Israel, the Israeli Minister of Finance were already planning what would happen if we have peace with Malaysia and Indonesia. This is already part of the thinking of it. And they are economically very strong business-wise in the word defense, if we would have customs from them, whatever not. And the Qataris understood that they're on the wrong side of the thing. And the Qataris stopped to give money to the Hamas. The Hamas was seeing that they're losing out. The Iranians were seeing that they're losing out. This was the cause for the war. This was the cause, at least for the timing of the war. And they'd planned it 2.5 years earlier. But we were going on, this is a process that was going on for the last 2 to 3 years. And it was one of the causes of the war. So now the fight is to get back exactly to that. We're speaking about the day after. The day after is to revive that concept. Under conditions that will be very, very difficult.
If you open a newspaper in Norway or in other European countries, many people seem to believe that they have the right perspective on the political situation, whether it's a two-state solution, a one-state solution, and some confederation. We have in the Norwegian big newspaper Aftenposten recently a couple pieces of information and columns that are trying to explain these things. And all these solutions have been discussed for many, many decades. And could you, when you are talking about in your paper and in your forthcoming book, also the day, what we call the day after, what are the possibilities of these things going forward? So two-state solutions and then all the other solutions that have been discussed. You discussed that and you have views on it. And Torkel, you might also fill in if you want.
Yeah, if you want stability and peace, the only way out is a two-state solution. There is no one-state solution. One state is either we kill the Palestinians or they kill us, or both, which is not very. A confederation, you know, if you look, a confederation is a two-state solution. A two-state solution with understandings. Now, we need milestones to go to the two-state solution. We need an understanding how this system can work. Part of the problem has been the shortcomings of not only of Israel, we have also, of course, we have shortcomings, but those of the Palestinian Authority. And major mistake we made in negotiations in the 90s that we kept the religious actors out. And both societies, I'm not religious, so for me, you know, But in both societies, religion is a very strong social, political, and economic traditional force. And we will need religious peace. There's a lot of civil society work going on there. You have for many years already, for 10, 15 years, we have in Israel, you know, if you look at Judaism, like any religion, you can always choose whatever you want. But in my eyes, the militant radicals, the Smotriches and Ben Gvir, in my eyes, they're not even Jews. And Judaism demands that we come to terms with the Palestinians. And I think the same is true on the Islamic side. The same you've got a Muslim leader of the Southern Islamic movement in Israel, Dr. Mansour Abbas, who says this publicly, extremely courageous, enormous respect of him. I hope he will get a lot of votes in the next Israeli election. And but there's a wider need to create the persecutor of the ICC, of the International Criminal Court already said that this is Hamas is not Islam. This is an outrage. This is against all laws of Quran, Hadith, and Tafsir, and whatever you want. And you will need a strong. Now you have United Arab Emirates who are leading this also in other ways. You have the Pope who is very crank at the moment, and I hope he'll live. But you know. He's a wonderful man, but, you know. And you have the Western interest for moderate Islam. I'm quoting in the book, not knowing this chapter, but I'm quoting Muslim intellectuals, in particular in Germany, who all are very, very, say, you know, Islam is different. And the struggle for a moderate ethical Islam is an interest, is a global interest. For Europe, it is decisive. If the Europeans don't understand that, they will be in big trouble. If, God forbid, if we are hurt, we are at the front, like the Ukrainians are on the front in the war against Russia, we are in the front against Islamic militancy.
So you are moving into different territory now, Yair, about you're talking about religion and culture, because so far we've talked a lot about institutions and negotiations and so on. I think it's very interesting that you bring up culture to talk about the general thing. You mentioned some of the hardliners in the Israeli government, like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and these people, and you often hear that, you know, political culture in Israel has been more influenced by these kinds of very far-right and religious voices over the past years. And on the others, on the Palestinian side, it seems also that people have become at least not less religious, probably more. I mean, these are global forces, and some of the religious movements also gain more followers in the Palestinian population. And I read there was a very interesting article by two of the negotiators that you worked with on the Palestinian side, Hussein Aga and Ahmed Khalidi, writing in 2021 about what they call a Palestinian reckoning. You may recall that article, Yair. I don't know if you read it, but they argued that, you know, the political developments have sort of left the Palestinians behind, because there has been this normalization between Israel and the Arab states. So the Palestinians need to reinvent themselves in a way. I mean, politically, but maybe also in terms of political culture. Can you say something more about this? I'm really curious about your perspective. What needs to change in political culture?
Now, Hussein Aga and Ahmed Khalidi are good friends. They're wonderful people. They grew up together in Beirut. When they were 6 years, they went together to grammar school. And since they are together, and they've been, particularly Hussein, been involved in all negotiations since 1993-94. Hussein negotiated the 2014 agreement, which Netanyahu accepted and Abbas rejected. And Hussein is very critical about Palestinian political behavior, which he's writing also about it. If he speaks with me, he's even more critical, which I understand. Now, if you speak about me, if I hear the names Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, I get a hot head. They are provocators. They are delegitimizing Israel. They are threats to the very well-being of Israel. That Netanyahu is taking them into his government is an act that is outrageous. When Ben-Gvir came into the Knesset, Bennett, who is national religious, said, that I have to explain that this is not acceptable is outrageous. And they are danger. They are danger for us Israelis. And if we don't limit the activities, they have caused trouble in the West Bank. They are inciting against Arabs everywhere. They've incited settlers to provoke Palestinians. There have been 8 or 10 Palestinians being killed by settler violence in the last time. Ben-Gvir has been in charge of police, has opposed to take action. The Shabak has publicly called into order. He has rejected their call. And in the last 2 or 3 days, and only too late, but late. The Minister of Defense, Gallant, is taking administrative action against these settlers and putting them into arrest under custody, which is good, but it should have been done earlier. And I think they have to be far more, take far more action against them.
On the Palestinian side, what needs to change there in political culture, you think? Yair? Sorry, Mathilde.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, you know, the PA is a disaster in many ways. You know, it's extremely important as a structure. There are very good people in some of the administration. But Abbas has a 17% rate of support. The PLO is full of fractions. We have a history of Palestinian people who've been always, there was always divide and conquer rule by whoever controlled the Palestinians. And now there's an effort. There will be an effort, we're speaking of a reconstructed, a reconstituted, a reformed Palestinian Authority. There are some ideas going on, but I must say I prefer not to speak about it. The moment you speak about it, you kill it. And but there are some interesting ideas being out there, and I hope that we can move ahead on that. What we will need is expert groups. We will need a technocratic government, and you'll need expert groups, Israeli, Palestinian, Jordanian, Egyptian, Saudi, UAE, expert groups to working together on a wider process.
You have, you can also maybe elaborate a bit on the Israeli politics situation. You started out a bit now, but we have Netanyahu and the Likud, and we have also polls showing that Benny Gantz from the National Unity Party is becoming more popular. So what do you see will change or could and should change in Israeli politics in order to go forward? It's difficult, and you're laughing, I know, but maybe give us some reflections if you can talk about it.
You know, you have a strong, strong division in Israel. The present government who came to power in December 2022, the end of December, they went through what they call the judicial reform, which is outrageous. And there was a very strong protest movement of hundreds of thousands of Israelis protesting every September. Every Saturday and in between. And now, on the 7th October, there was this disaster. On the 8th of October, the government ceased to exist. There is the failure of the 8th of October. Nobody is speaking about yet, but they will speak about it. The government was not there. And all the issues to put things together were done by the protest movement. You had what we call Achim Baneshek, Brethren in Arms. I'll give you an example. You had the cows were not milked, everything was destroyed. All the kibbutzim, they're all left wing. All my friends, you know, they're all my. All the houses, everything was burnt down, destroyed, people killed. But you had cows who were not milked. How do you call milked? For 3 days, which is painful. So you had people of the arm running, going there and milking the cows. You had something else. You have in the south, you have a silo, you have big silos of all the seeds for the entire agriculture of the south. And there was no electricity, the electricity burnt down. This would have gone down, would have been totally destroyed. If not our people, the people from Brethren, Brethren in Arms, would have gone then and organized it and make it happen. Now we don't know if this will. Now you have the present government. We have a major fight on financing. Do we use is the Israeli budget going to pay for the political needs of the present government of all kind of groups who are a disaster and don't do anything, and only are totally ineffective, or they do it for the needs that are there, and there's a big fight over it. there will be a strong fight over who is responsible. You know, you might have a situation, or you most likely have a situation, and then the war is over, that the chief of staff and the chief of Israeli intelligence and the chief of the Shabak will resign, will say, we made big mistakes, and we take responsibility, and we will resign. And then we'll say, you know, Mr. Prime Minister, you since 2014, 2015, you allowed $2 billion to pay for Hamas. You allowed them to go in. You have a responsibility. You have to resign too. And there will be tremendous pressure for him to resign. You have the entire, all the hostage families and all of them will be invaded. Now, I don't know what's going to happen. The government and Netanyahu are wonderful propagandists. They are already working on a sign of agreement that the entire fault of October 7th is the Oslo agreement. No way. Me. And, you know, I don't know how much people, if you can make Norwegians believe all kind of wrong information, you can make Israelis also believe some wrong information. Mm. It's going to be an internal struggle. In a way, I don't know how it will work. What I'll know is that we'll be fighting really inside a very, very serious fight. If we get support from the outside, whatever, it will be very essential. It's ahead of us. And I can't tell you that I can assure you the goodies will win and the baddies will lose. It must always happen that way.
But you, in the draft for your book and the first chapter, and you also mentioned it a little while ago, you mentioned the milestones, the need to define milestones, starting with the conclusion of a long-term ceasefire. And we are not in a long-term ceasefire position right now. But those milestones were really interesting, even though you haven't spelled them out in detail, at least what I have read. But could you take us through those milestones that you see and you have? I'm not sure how many there were at least. I'll have to see.
There were 10.
10, yes. Okay, so 10 milestones. So what are they?
I'm not sure if I remember them in all.
Well, some of them, the most important things.
So the first one is to do a ceasefire and to take care of humanitarian relief. And we have detailed ideas of humanitarian relief. We have a clear picture about the need of the costs involved. There's been, Gaza is almost totally destroyed in the north and in the south less, but also quite strongly. So you have to organize the humanitarian relief in a way that Hamas cannot take control of it and criminal groups cannot take control of it. Now, there will have to be at the beginning Israeli security control, but you need at the very beginning some kind of structure that we have not discussed yet and we don't know yet fully. The UAE is coming out with the idea of a Arab peace building force. I would be happy if this can be done. I would prefer NATO somehow in that. We will need some kind of American support. The Americans are very hesitant to go there. But you need a structure that can take care of the immediate needs of over 1 million. 1.5 million people who are destitute and in big, big, big trouble. This is definitely milestone number one. We need milestone, I don't know if this is, I'm not in the order of whatever, we need action to delegitimize Hamas completely. The International Criminal Court, taking the responsible for the war crimes. Even if we assume that there were some Hamas pockets here and there, they have to be put on trial. The criminal acts have to put in trial, according to what Karim Khan actually said he's going to do. You have to take away all money from Hamas. will have to say that they cannot govern by anything, and they will have money to take cut off all the financial sources. Then you start the rebuilding process. Rebuilding process is, first of all, to make life more natural. We are working, for instance, with this in Israel, the Arab, by the way, I deleted it. We have the Israeli Economic Forum, Israeli Arab Economic Forum, Israeli Palestinians, who organizes very well to do business people, very powerful, financially, politically less, but are very powerful, who can start to organize small business activities there. Then you need a transition arrangement. How does the Israeli army slowly get out? And with Palestinian okay, this peacekeeping force gets more and more control of it, and we will rebuild it. Now, what is very important, and we're working on details on it, you cannot only develop economic development in the Gaza. You have deep difficulties in the West Bank of the economic. The war has cost enormous costs, economic costs for West Bank Palestinians. And we are preparing a plan, an economic, what we call a leap forward plan, where you have to develop Palestinian economic development in Gaza and the West Bank, embedded in the wider regional activities. Now, this is an economic interest of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates anyway. They have very expensive economies. They have huge, huge monies available. And then you've got the United Arab, part of the idea is to have this railway connection from the Indian Ocean to the Gulf. They're building railways to the Jordanian border. You need 400 kilometers Jordanian railway system into Palestine and Israel. And then you have connected. You have, only to give you the numbers, you have presently a $599 billion UAE foreign trade budget. I always say this is more than I've got in my pocket.
And you also have some milestone 8, 9, and 10, and they are, of course, negotiations to prepare the peace plan and also the
Saudi Arabian peace plan.
Yeah, Saudi Arabian, U.S.
And
Saudi
you will need elections. You'll need elections in Israel and in Palestine.
Yes.
And you will then need Biden and BDS. This all is a process, and nobody can tell how much time every event phase takes, but we have to work on that.
What about the role of Qatar and Hamas?
I'm not a big lover of Qatar, to put it mildly. You know, they have a hedge fund policy. They have the biggest military base, U.S. military base on their grounds. So they have the United States supporting them. And then they, for years and years, they've paid huge sums in propaganda against Israel. They paid huge sums in incitement for military Islamic, most wild incitement for terrorists, for madrasot in Europe and elsewhere. They've supported Hamas and others, other terrorist groups with arms, with military things, with all of that. And they played this double game. I tried to call them to order in 2014. We had this experience. In 2012, we had this experience that the war broke out. It was a Gaza war. And Obama wrongly negotiated with the Qataris and the Turks. And the Egyptians didn't want it and said, you know, we do. You had Hillary Clinton as still the Secretary of State. Her closest advisor was a good friend of mine, Jeff Feltman. So I would work with Jeff Feltman and with the UN Secretary, UN Peace Envoy Robert Seri. Nimrod Novik would work with the Egyptians. Baruch Spiegel would work with the Israeli army. And we helped to negotiate an Egyptian centered things. There was an agreement between Egypt and Hamas and Israel to have a ceasefire. The Qataris intervened and said, no, the ceasefire has to be with us. And it started all over again. And they killed many more Palestinians and more Israelis for another 6 or 8 days. In the end, Hillary Clinton said, you know, we made a mistake speaking to the Qataris. We do this with Egypt, and we got the deal through that we actually were negotiating. But from that moment on, I looked more at Qatar, and I said, you know, put the Qataris in order. I asked the Americans. I had a fellowship at the Baker Institute, wrote a paper on it. The paper was not published, but I was kicked out. That was the end of my fellowship because they got a lot of money from them. And this is the Qataris had invested in all the think tanks over there. So this Qatari money has been part of the anti-Western propaganda machine. Now, I believe that now we move forward, the Qataris will come along with us. Now we need the Qataris. We need the Qataris to get the hostages out. They are playing a very constructive role at the moment. And I believe they will continue to play a constructive role. They need some guidance and persuasion from the United States. There are certain things the Americans are willing to do, certain things they're not willing to do. I'm in discussion with them. This is it's part of in the doing. But the ones who really will call them to order are the Saudis. The Saudis will tell them, you know, there's enough. So, and I understand, you know, it's a hedge fund policy that small countries like this do that, you know, to be on both sides.
Torkil, do you have any questions to finish up the conversation?
No, I think it has been fascinating to speak to Yair about both his past, about his key role in the peace process, which is 30 years, and also I'm just getting really curious to read his forthcoming book mainly. So that's you have been very kind to let us have a little peek at some of the parts of that manuscript, which has been fascinating. So I think that this has been a very interesting talk, Matilda.
Yes, you fell out there, Torkil, but what we will say is that the book that you will publish, Yair, is almost, we said it will be coming this summer, so maybe you can just tell us the title of it and what we should look into and where we could get it. It's just, it's in English, as I could read, because you sent us English pages. So what is it called and when is it coming?
It's the International Springer Publishing House. It's called The Israeli-Palestinian Peace Process, an insider account, 2000, from the beginning section to now, with no dates. And it describes in the first, the first chapter now is what happened. But then when the original first chapter starts, this is my growing up in Vienna and my formative years. And then the involvement of the peace process since 67 onwards, and the lessons learned, the Oslo process, how the Oslo process unfolded. There's a long patch on the difficulties, the setbacks we had during the 90s. There's a very painful chapter on the Barak episode. I'm very critical of Barak. And then onward, the Sharon and Olmert years, I describe that Israel wanted a strong Gaza and a strong that we opened up everything for... And you have it in Palestine, in Abdul Mahdi Hadi's part of the documents are there, part are not published, that Israel offered a railway between Gaza and the West Bank. This even this is also under Netanyahu, by the way, a safe passage, a seaport, an airport, negotiations on the airport. And all of this was that Israel has a vested interest in an economically thriving Gaza. I described that that Hamas, the moment and in 2015, I prepared a paper. There were seven papers that I edited, and I didn't know that if the military wing of Hamas, in order to maintain their existence, they have to always to threaten us. The moment if they always threaten us, you can't develop economic. You don't invest in a country where you have war next time. And that closing up Gaza, seeing Gaza as a prison, is only half truth our fault. The more truth is that the Hamas has created the situation by, instead of developing economic development in Gaza, buying rockets and missiles against us. And we have the right to defend ourselves. And we did it by creating a siege on Gaza. I think we could have done more in order to overcome it. I believe that from 2014 onwards, the Israeli government made all the mistakes it could have made. And then I go on, there were secret negotiations from 2016, by the way, with under Norwegian leadership, between 2016 and 2020, there was secret track 2 negotiations, which Netanyahu, in a way, supported without being obliged to it, and Abbas didn't take serious. Then the negotiators who, I don't want to tell you who, who saw the Norwegians out. The Norwegians were kicked out of the negotiations. Then they kicked me out. Then they kicked me out, but they called me back again when a kind of agreement was signed by Abu Lahan, the Palestinian side, and the Israeli side in 2020. These negotiations went on. They were they were leading to what became afterwards the Saudi Peace Initiative and Arab Accords. And then I'm writing about the end. And the end, the last chapter is questions and answers. You know, I will be 80 in June. It's time for the younger generation to take over. So I'm writing questions and answers to the younger generation. What my concepts are, and whether they are going to follow what I'm saying or they do something else. That's the book. That's the book. And I hope it will come out by the by February will be out.
Okay, so we'll have to tell the listeners of Liberal Haltime that they could go on and buy this book, and we will certainly also link to it in this episode when this comes out just after Christmas. So I will just say a huge thank you for taking your time, Yair, from Tel Aviv, really crossing my fingers for the process to go in the way that you have tried to explain to us, even though you had milestones going on for a long, long time and into the future and many uncertainties. So thanks a lot for joining us today, Yair, and thank you to Torkil also.
Thank you very much. Thank you both to you.
If you like Liberal Haltime, you can rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Du hører på Liberal Haltime, en podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne media.